I'm Reiner Fulmich. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law as a trial lawyer for the last 28 years. I'm licensed to practice law both in Germany and in California. But most of my work as an attorney has been done in Germany. So most of my courtroom experience is German. My firm and I, we used to be 17 lawyers plus paralegals, IT people, etc., etc. We have only represented consumers and small and medium-sized businesses, usually against large corporations such as VW, Volkswagen, Deutsche Bank, and then there's the world's largest shipping company. Nobody knows its name, but it's Kühne & Nagel. We went after them for extortion and bribery.
Your technical title would be like a global fraud attorney, right?
I would call myself a consumer protection attorney specializing in bank law. Mm-hmm.
So if you told yourself when you were 15 that you would be standing where you are today, did you see that coming?
No. But I have, my father was a police officer, and he became a police officer right after the war, World War II, not exactly right after the war, 1952, when the Bremen police force, Bremen is my hometown in Germany, when they were built up from scratch, more or less, because there weren't any police officers anymore. And he did it. He became a police officer because he really believed in justice. And after a while, however, he told me that he became a little bit frustrated because in many of the cases, or let's not say many, but in some of the cases which he and his colleagues investigated and then decided we're going to have to turn this over to the DA's office so that he'll go after these people. They didn't do anything. And it turns out that in those cases, they were dealing with powerful, either politically or financially powerful people. There's a saying in Germany that they hang the poor and they let the rich go when it comes to such criminal activities. That means that if you steal, for example, a tennis racket, you may go to jail. But if you defraud people out of hundreds of millions of euros or dollars, you may go scot-free. That's how it works. That's how the system works in Germany. Now, I had only heard these stories from him. And at the time, when I was 15, I was still in school. But after I graduated, I first went to high school in Michigan, and then I graduated from a German school. I became a soldier. I enlisted for 12 years. And then after about a year, I decided, this is not for me. I can't accept orders from people who are obviously crazy. So that is when I remembered what my father had told me, and I decided to go to law school so that I would sort of follow in his footsteps, but on a different level. So my goal has always been, it's never been about money. I mean, you do have to make money in order to make a living, but I have always been in this because of justice, because that is the foundation of any democracy. If there's no justice, there cannot be a democracy.
I'm trying here to kind of get the bigger picture with all three of you. So for someone who's never really been exposed to any of this, so if we can just kind of jump back to the beginning of the pandemic, one of the things that fueled this fear was the PCR. Yeah. So
yeah.
I would love to discuss the PCR.
Yes. Well, at first, of course, nobody had heard anything about PCR testing. I didn't even know who Carrie Mullis was. And my wife and I were still living up there in Northern California. I was working on a brief, and she was annoying me because she was listening to a German podcast, a German medical doctor who was explaining how this pandemic isn't for real. And he had such an annoying voice. And I told her, please turn it down a little. But eventually, I heard some snippets of what he said, and it seemed to be interesting. So I went down and listened to that guy. And we both of us decided there's something wrong. There's something really wrong about this. Of course, at first I believed that this would be limited to Europe because that's where it seems to have started. But it was very quick that I understood that this is going to spread everywhere. In order to get more information about the backdrop of this, I talked to my friend Dr. Wolfgang Wodak, who is a renowned and very experienced lung specialist. I think he's in his early or mid-70s now. And he's the one who stopped the swine flu in 2009, which I had totally, completely forgotten about. And but when I called him in order to get his take on this, he said, well, this looks like the swine flu 2.0. However, it sounds like it's going to be much worse. And then I looked it up. I decided, what is the swine flu? And there's this still this YouTube movie. It's called Profiteers of Fear. It's about the swine flu in 2009. But having watched it for 5 minutes, it looked and sounded as though this was about what's going on currently, the corona crisis. But of course, it was after a while, it was clear that this was a prior attempt at creating a pandemic. How did they do that back then? Well, they changed, they is the World Health Organization, they changed the definition of what a pandemic is. Up until then, a pandemic consisted of three elements: a worldwide disease spreading worldwide, many serious cases of illness, and many deaths. Then they changed it, and now it is a pandemic is only a worldwide disease. No more serious cases, no more many cases of deaths are required. That means you can make any flu into a pandemic. That's what they did then, and then they had a number of people, some of whom are still around, who proclaimed that things would be terrible. People would be dying. Millions of people would be dying unless they got vaccinated. They got pretty far back then. They even managed to get people to get vaccinated. Not so many in Germany, because back then they didn't have these vaccination centers, but it was the family doctors who had to do this. And many of them were not in line with the government, but simply wanted the best for their patients and advised them not to take the shots because the immune system works really well. But many children in the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, many of the children who got vaccinated then, I think a total of 1,300, are permanently disabled now because they suffer from narcolepsy. So when Wolfgang was able to stop this, I'm saying this because he was then in a position of political power. He was a member of the German parliament, the German Bundestag, which is the equivalent of Congress. And he was also a member of the Council of Europe. And that's a position with lots of power. That's why he managed to pry this whole thing open, take a close look into the details of what's going on, and he realized then, and this was published by the mainstream media in 2010, and he realized that this was a fake pandemic and that the only people who are profiting from this is the pharmaceutical industry. So that stopped that, but that was, as it now turns out, the precursor of what we're dealing with right now. Basically the same people. And again, it's a fake pandemic. They were on the news, they were constantly talking about these cases, and incidences. All of these cases, as they call them, were based on PCR testing. And that is, that's the only basis for anything they've ever done. It's the lockdowns, the social distancing, hand washing, and of course, the vaccinations. And one day, this is about 2 months into our work as the Corona Committee, I was riding the subway in Berlin. I was riding the subway with Wolfgang. And when he was about to get off, he told me, well, you do know that the PCR test cannot tell you anything about infections. I pulled him back in and said, I don't. You have to explain this to me. Do we have an expert for this? Because we needed experts to interview on the Corona Committee. And he mentioned the name of a professor of biology. Her name is Ulrike Kämmerer from Würzburg University, which is in the center of Germany and Bavaria. But he also mentioned a bunch of other names. Dolores Cahill is one of them. She's, I think she's an immunologist, a professor of immunology from Dublin University in Ireland. Then there's Professor Kapel from the Netherlands and many, many others. Ultimately, I got in touch with Mike Yeadon, Dr. Mike Yeadon, a former vice president of Pfizer. He was their chief science officer for 16 years. So I began to talk to these people, and one after another, we had them on our Corona committee, and they all testified to the same effect. The PCR test is a great tool. It's perfect. It was invented by a brilliant mind by the name of Kary Mullis. He won a Nobel Prize for this in 1992, I believe. It cannot be used for diagnostic purposes in the sense of finding out whether or not somebody is infected or even ill. Why is that? Well, there's basically two reasons. Reason number one, the test cannot distinguish between dead and live matter. So if you test positive, it means that it has found a fragment of the coronavirus, because that's what it's looking for. It only looks for the coronavirus. It doesn't look for any other viruses. So it has found a fragment of the coronavirus. But this may very well be the remnants of your body's immune system's fight against the common cold or the flu, because coronaviruses, there are four of them, are endemic. That means they exist. They've been in existence cohabitating with humans for decades. So if it finds that coronavirus, it could very well be that it's just the remnant of your body's immune system's fight against the flu or the common cold, which may have happened 4 or 5 months ago. For an infection, you need to have a whole virus, and that's reason number two why it can't work. You need to have a whole virus enter the cells and starting to replicate there. That's when you're infected, because that's when you have symptoms too. So you need a whole virus. This test never finds a whole virus, because whatever is on the swabs that's taken from the nose or the throat is crushed so that there's no whole virus left anymore. And then you put it into a machine, and then this machine is set so that you will know and see what is really in there. This is done. This is a kind of magnifying, I guess you could call it. It's called cycles of amplification, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, etc., etc. But everyone agrees now that anything beyond 24 cycles of amplification is totally unscientific, because you all of a sudden everything becomes visible, everything and anything. And Mike Yeadon told us that at 35 cycles of amplification, you end up with at least 90% false positives. Now, the first tests that were designed in the context of corona by this now infamous professor, Dr. Drosten from Germany, were set at 45 cycles of amplification. This was recommended to the entire world by the World Health Organization as the gold standard for the detection of viruses, in this case the coronavirus. Even the Frankfurt Public Health Agency says we do not consider anything beyond 24 cycles of amplification. If you also take into consideration that at 35 cycles of amplification you end up with at least 90% false positives, what do you expect at 40 to 45 cycles of amplification? So those are the two reasons why, no matter how you apply the test, it cannot tell us anything about infections. It cannot distinguish between dead and live matter, and it cannot find a whole virus. However, as I just said, this test was applied in a very unscientific manner. It had so many, what they call the Corman-Drosten protocol, which is a kind of an article they wrote on how to test people with the PCR test. It has so many defects, so to speak. It's a highly defective paper. But the worst of it is that they recommended cycles of amplification of 45. That is guaranteed to produce false positives. And that's what happened. they first discussed whether or not this strange new virus from Wuhan in China was going to cause a pandemic. Well, as we now know, they wanted a pandemic because that is the ultimate goal here. They want to keep us in panic mode. They needed this in order to divert our attention from what they've been doing. They've been looting and plundering our public coffers for decades. One of the results is the housing crisis, which started here in the United States and then turned into a worldwide financial and economic crisis back then in 2009, which is no coincidence that they at the same time had the swine flu pandemic, which didn't quite work out. But back then in 2009, what we should have done is we should have taken a closer look. We should have held everyone responsible. This is my area of expertise as an attorney. We should have realized that they had been acting fraudulently, the financial industry, the financial mafia, as I now call them. The central banks and other banks started to print money. But by printing money, it's like monopoly money, you cannot solve a problem. So what happened in 2009, what should have been solved then, happened again in September of 2019. That is when there was another banking crisis, which nobody really noticed, except for a few insiders. It's called a repo crisis, when banks will not lend each other money overnight anymore because they don't trust each other. So that was the next big crisis. This time, they knew they didn't have any way out. And we're in possession of a paper that was written. It's a kind of a summary that was written by BlackRock, which is one of the large hedge funds. So there's this summary written by BlackRock about a meeting of the central bankers, which happens once a year in Jackson Hole in Wyoming. And I'm not quoting them verbatim now, but it reads something, or they're saying something to the effect of, oh my God, this time they're really on to us. We have to take drastic measures. Drastic measures, that's what Corona is. So they needed cases in January of 2020, but there weren't any. There were no cases. They applied a lot of pressure on the World Health Organization, asking their emergency committee to meet. They met in mid-January, but couldn't agree on the declaration of a public health emergency of international concern. The term pandemic is for the general public, but internally, what they really wanted is this public health emergency of international concern. But in order to declare this, you have to have cases. Why did they want it, by the way? They didn't need it for lockdowns or mask mandates or social distancing, but they needed it for new drugs, new totally untested drugs to be used on humans. Unless you have a health emergency, that's what this is, a public health emergency of international concern, you cannot use untested new drugs because you're not going to get a what they now call in the US an emergency use authorization, or in Europe it's a conditional use authorization. So they needed this public health emergency of international concern, but they didn't have any cases. But then, because they didn't have any cases, then they agreed, oh, well, but it's still dangerous out there in Wuhan. We don't know what's going on. We're going to have to meet again 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks later, they met again. Then they declared the public health emergency of international concern. What had changed? Nothing. Except that this Drosten guy, Professor Dr. Drosten of Charité University in Berlin, that he had provided them with his test, and with the help of this test, set at 45 cycles of amplification, they created cases. They had thousands and thousands of cases. That's how they created the public health emergency of international concern, and that is the only foundation for any and all of the measures, including and above all the so-called vaccinations. What is most important is that we show in the courts of law or in the court of public opinion by educating the people that this is a long-planned agenda. And the best way to do it is by going after the PCR test. Because if you hear that story, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. And pretty much everyone who we spoke with, all of the scientists, all of the doctors of medicine, all of them told us the same story.
How have you spoken to all these people? So let's kind of talk about the Corona Investigative Committee. You know, how is that born and what does it consist of today?
Well, it came into existence because both my wife and I, when we were still here in California, could see, even from a distance, that we would not get any answers from our politicians or from the mainstream media. All of a sudden, it became clear to both of us that our politicians are either liars or plain stupid. We realized we would not get any answers from them or from the mainstream media. My wife said, well, maybe it's going to be different when we're back in Germany, but it wasn't. And that is when Wolfgang Wodak connected me with, because I said, Wolfgang, if you want me to do something, because that's the only reason we came back. I would have stayed here and sat things out. That's what I told my wife. I said, Inka, let's stay here. This is nice and quiet and calm. We're safe. And she said, nah, this is not going to stay like this. And as it turns out, it didn't. But so we went back. When I asked Wolfgang, I need someone who's going to cooperate with me. I can't do anything all by myself. He says, well, there's this woman who has filed a petition asking for a baseline study because she wanted answers to the very same questions that we were asking ourselves. And he put me in touch with Vivian Fischer. I met her in Berlin and I thought, well, this woman is powerful. She has a lot to say. She's very smart and she has tons and tons of energy and many great ideas. We first discussed to have a kind of a conference, a scientific conference of sorts, so that what we thought the Bundestag should have done, set up an investigative committee, that we're going to do this on our own, but not as an investigative committee, but rather as a one-weekend, extended weekend conference. And she immediately says, no, 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 this is much worse. This is not, we're not going to be able to deal with this in 3 days or 4 days. And then we agreed on setting up, as an alternative to what they should have done, the Bundestag should have done, the government, the parliament should have done, we agreed on setting up our own investigative committee and called it the Berlin Corona Investigative Committee. But again, we thought, well, this is going to go once we met once a week, because both of us have our own real job still. We're still attorneys. And we thought, well, this is going to go for 6 weeks at the most. And now we just finished the day before yesterday, we just finished our 102nd session. In the meantime, we've interviewed more than 150. I think Vivian told me this morning it's been over 170 experts from all walks of science, medical doctors, lawyers, economists, psychiatrists and psychologists, because that is probably the most important aspect of this, apart from the fact that we have to know the backdrop, which is what Patrick Wood is great in. But we also have to understand why are so many people falling for this? And it has to do with psychology, of course. So we spoke with many professors of psychology and psychiatry. We also spoke with many politicians, a former American politician. She's a former investment banker and assistant secretary of housing and urban development, Catherine Austin Fitz, a former premier of the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador, Brian Peckford, but also with a California politician. She's an active politician. Her name is Sue Frost. She's one of the 5 members of the Board of Supervisors of Sacramento County. This totality of the evidence amounts to the following findings. One, there is no pandemic. There never was a pandemic, or, well, if there was one, it's a PCR test pandemic, because it's created by a PCR test. There weren't any cases. And because there are alternative methods of treatment, or more aptly said, real methods of treatment. Protect your immune system by through vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, ivermectin, Ivermectin is, of course, a method of treatment that works, but also hydroxychloroquine. Now, I'm not a doctor. I can't give you any of the details that go with this, but that is what they told us. There are methods of treatment, normal methods of treatment. This is how you treat a respiratory virus, and this is a respiratory virus. It is both safe and effective. That's finding number one. There is no pandemic because there's only a PCR test pandemic, and there are other ways, other methods of treatment. Finding number two, which this leads automatically to the question, well, if it's not about health, what is it about? Finding number two is we cannot trust our governments because most governments, at least those in the Western world, in Europe in particular, are not our governments anymore, but they are creations, our leaders, the people who we thought we voted for, they're creations of the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Program. This has been in existence since 1992. And since 1992, they graduated pretty much everyone who then got voted into office, at least in Europe, but in many other parts of the world as well. We know that the first, among the first two graduates of this program of 1992 were Angela Merkel, our former chancellor, and Bill Gates. Then there's others, Premier or Prime Minister Aznar of Spain, a former Prime Minister of Spain. There's the current President of France, Macron. There's Justin Trudeau of Canada. There's Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand. In fact, the founder of the World Economic Forum, which is the basis for this Young Global Leaders Program, Klaus Schwab, he explicitly states in a video that he's proud that his Young Global Leaders Program has infiltrated at least half of the Canadian Parliament. So that tells you who's really pulling the strings. The psychologists and psychiatrists who we spoke with said is they're psychopaths, sociopaths. They think they're omnipotent. They think of themselves as God, so to speak. One of the people who works for them and with them is an Israeli professor of history. He's not even a scientist, a professor of history. I think he's 46 years old. His name is Harari. And he's proud that we can now hack the human genome, the human brain. We can make people do things that they wouldn't do unless they're being manipulated. That's what technocracy is about. That's Patrick's big theme. The World Economic Forum consists of 1,000 global corporations with sales of at least $5 billion a year, I believe, plus thousands of politicians. That's who they need in order to have them go through their Young Global Leaders Program, plus media people, and then there's other VIPs that they use for different purposes. That is their main platform, I believe. The World Economic Forum, everyone thinks, is a creation of Klaus Schwab's. Well, it is, to a degree, but Klaus Schwab went to Harvard in the 1960s, and he had enrolled in a program, a summer school program, I believe, which was conducted by Henry Kissinger, and which was funded by the CIA. In those days, in the 1960s, U.S. foreign policy decided to change tack from nuclear deterrence in Europe. This is with respect to Europe. Nuclear deterrence, how can we keep up nuclear deterrence, to how can we influence European politics? And they used Klaus Schwab to set up this World Economic Forum through which they intended to influence European politics. And they were really successful at that. In the meantime, this World Economic Forum has become not just an entity of importance in Europe, but it's important for the rest of the world. It may be the nexus between Europe and the United States. I'm not sure about that. But their main tool, their main crowbar, is the World Health Organization. This is all about health. They're using health as the crowbar to push through their agenda. It is easy to set people into panic by creating a virus or by creating the illusion of there being a dangerous virus out there, because everyone is concerned about their health, obviously. So they're using this as their major crowbar, the World Health Organization. And right now it looks as though through the World Health Organization's international health regulations, they're trying to overrule our national constitutions and our national laws. All 194, I believe, member states of the World Health Organization will then be ruled by the World Health Organization or by the World Economic Forum, or rather by the people who are pulling their strings. If this is not about health, what is their goal? Well, the ultimate goal is, it's all out there in the open. You can read up on this in the Great Reset, which was written by Klaus Schwab. Or you can listen to the interviews that this aforementioned Harari did. What they really want is complete control of the world, not just of animals and plants, but also of humans. This may sound like it's, I've watched too many James Bond movies, but unfortunately it's the truth. And, you know, it's all out there in the open. What they really want is, they want to have us agree to two things, to a one world government under the UN, which they own, the World Economic Forum, and they want us to agree to a one world digital currency along the lines of the Chinese social credit system, which they own. One bank, one digital currency. If you don't behave, you're not going to get any money. You're not going to get any access to anything. Those are the goals. Ultimately, they want to control the world. And in order to get there, they need to create as much chaos as possible, and they need to keep us in a constant mode of fear and panic. Number one, the corona crisis. Number two, and it's still, the corona crisis is not over. It's not over. Even though in some parts of the world it seems like it's over, but they're still working on this behind the scenes. They may come up with something new, another virus. I don't think so. I think the next thing they're going to do is they're going to say, oh, we just realized that HIV is back. Why? Well, because one of the side effects, one of the adverse effects of most of the vaccines, in particular the mRNA vaccines, is that they destroy your immune system. And all of a sudden, you have an autoimmune deficiency problem. Your immune system turns against your own body. And this is what happened with AIDS, or at least they claim that this is what happened with AIDS back then. There's still a discussion about whether or not AIDS was caused by HIV. Judy Mikovits says no. She sees the parallels between what's happening now with Fauci et al. And what happened then with Fauci et al. So we believe that the next big thing they're going to pull out of the hat is a new crisis, a new, what they claim, viral crisis, HIV, in order to distract our attention from the adverse effects of the vaccine, because that's what the mRNA vaccines cause. They destroy your immune system. After the third shot or so, you have probably less than 30% of your immune system. And that is becoming so visible that they can't sweep it under the rug anymore. It's even being discussed in the mainstream media. So they have to find an alternative explanation for that, and we believe it's going to be AIDS. Why do we think so? Well, there's five pieces of evidence that points in that direction. First, the virus, which was probably created in a lab, this is at least what our experts say, it was a man-made virus, or maybe part man-made. They did insert, again, this is layman's talk, but they inserted sequences of the HIV virus into the virus. They also, that's fact number one, they also inserted such sequences into the so-called vaccines. Then, after the first round of vaccinations in Australia, many people all of a sudden tested positive to the HIV virus, even though they didn't have any symptoms. Probably because they had developed antibodies to the HIV virus. Fact number four, there is a new drive here in the US. I think it's called AIDS awareness or something. And so we have to ask ourselves, where does that come from? There is no AIDS problem. at least there wasn't one before the vaccinations. I think Prince Harry, doesn't he live someplace around here? He's the major protagonist of this, AIDS awareness. Fact number five, Moderna, which is one of the two mRNA vaccine makers, and which is only a one-trick pony because they don't have anything but this one vaccine called COVID-19 vaccine. All of a sudden, they have gotten an EUA approval, an emergency use approval for a new AIDS or HIV vaccine. So if you take all of this together, then I think as an attorney in the legal analysis of these facts, you have to come to the conclusion that this is why they're doing it. They want to distract us by having us focus on an AIDS or HIV crisis. They want to distract our attention from the fact that this is caused by the vaccines. What it really is vaccine-induced AIDS.
You know, we have these big scares, this chaos, and people willingly just give away their privacy, give away their rights. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't continue in that state, that's the thing. This is not over. It will never be over.
No, unless we stop it.
Yeah. And I know we talked about this on the... you talked about this with Polly the other day. You know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Where do you see the world in 5 years if we don't?
Well, if we don't stop this, they will reach their goals, and that means that we'll have a one-world government, which is going to be a totalitarian government. We're already moving in that direction, and we will have a one-world digital currency. We will not be humans anymore because some of us may still be humans, but many others will have been genetically modified organisms. And so we have to stop this. There's no other way. We're keeping at it by trying to educate the public, by getting out the truth, exposing everything, giving them the entire story so that the theory that what we're saying is just a conspiracy theory, that people will understand by getting the backdrop, by listening, for example, to what Patrick has to say, they will understand that it makes perfect sense. If you only look at one or two or three snippets of what we have to say, well, then it doesn't make any sense. But if you see the whole picture, if you hear the whole story, then it does make sense. And this is not something that came about a year or two ago. This is something that's been going on for at least 100 years, maybe much longer, we don't know, but Patrick has explained in great detail that this has at least been going on for 100 years.
I think there's definitely some solutions to this, and I know that you have discussed basically, let's just talk about the Nuremberg trial for... So a lot of people don't even know what that is. In our movement, they're like, yeah, Nuremberg trial. But what was the Nuremberg trial?
Yeah.
And how can we kind of revisit that?
Well, yes, the Nuremberg trials, I think I was the first one to use this term in one of my videos. I made this video in which I reminded the people that there's always two sides to the story. To every story. As a lawyer, you learn that there's a Roman saying, it goes, audiatur et altera pars, which means you have to listen to the other side too. In the context of Corona, we were only hearing one side of the story. Actually, there's this one politician, or maybe he's not a politician, he's the German equivalent of Fauci. He runs the German equivalent of the CDC. His name is Professor Dr. Wheeler. He's probably fake, just like Drosten. But in one of his public appearances, he explicitly said, you're going to have to follow these orders, mask mandate, social distancing, et cetera, and you must not ask any questions. And when I heard that, I thought, this is completely anti-democratic. It is anti-science, because this is what democracy and science is all about. You have to ask questions, because if you don't, you're not going to learn anything. So the next video, which I made 2 months after we had started working on in our Corona committee, dealt with The findings in particular, the then brand new finding, this is in September of 2020, that the PCR test, which they used to create the cases, cannot tell us anything about infection. So I made that video. We had 500,000, then 1 million, then 1.5 million clicks, 15 million, then it went back down to 700,000. But I realized I was onto something. People seem to be interested. People seem to be interested in the very same questions that we, as the Corona Committee, were asking ourselves. And we also realized that the only way that people would make the right choices is by getting the real information. So what this means is that we're going to have to continue getting out the truth, exposing everything, try to reach others outside of our own bubble, which is really, really hard. But as one of the psychologists whom we interviewed, Professor Matthias Desmet from a Belgian university, as he explained to us, yes, there's 40% of the population who are probably hypnotized. He said, not like hypnotized. They are hypnotized because you can't reach them. But then there's still this 40% group of people who are sitting on the fence and who are beginning to ask themselves, is there something wrong with them? Many of them have been vaccinated, but still, they're still approachable. So that's the target group that we need to talk to. However, I do believe that if we continue with our efforts at educating the people and our legal efforts in the courts of law where it makes sense, we will still not be able to pull this off and turn this thing around. It is important to do that because if you just sit there and do nothing, it's going to get far worse, far quicker. But what ultimately, we will ultimately need more help. And that's why I'm saying if that Ukraine conflict spills over into a real war, in Europe at least, that is on the one hand terrible, but on the other hand, I think that is the time when a higher power will come to our aid. I keep saying I'm not religious because I don't believe in organized religion. It's all about power as far as I'm concerned. But I do believe, as my wife told me, that there is a cosmic equilibrium, a cosmic kind of a cosmic balance, and it's totally out of whack right now. I do believe that there is a higher power out there. I do believe in spirituality, even as a rational attorney. So I think that those two elements, our educating the people, our going into the courts of law and filing cases where it makes sense, is just one part of the whole game. The other part is probably just as important, if not more. It's probably crucial that some spiritual power will, which connects us all, will come to our aid. We don't need organized religion.
No.
We can do our own thing.
Yeah.
Most of us understand what's good and evil, what's right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. I think that we all have some kind of moral compass.
Yeah.
That's what comes from.
And that's, by the way, that's to answer your question. Got off track there.
Hey, I like tangents.
That's what the Nuremberg trials were all about.
Yeah.
They conducted these trials after the end of World War II. It was not just one trial. There was one trial against what they call the main war criminals, but there weren't very many left. Many had fled to Latin America. Many had gone to the United States through this, what they call Operation Paperclip, German scientists, which helped one of them. His name is Werner von Braun. He's the one who created the space program. And but there's others who were used by the CIA and other intelligence branches to, for example, in this mind control thing, MK Ultra. I don't know if you've heard of this. Really strange things, very strange things. But so many got away. That's what's wrong with the Nuremberg trials. But at least there was a symbolic act. It showed the world we're not going to let them get away. But there are also, apart from this main war criminal thing, there are also five or six other trials that dealt with the doctors who had conducted these horrific experiments in the concentration camps. And one of the what they thought best defenses of these people was, well, we only followed orders. And that's when the court decided, that cannot be a good defense. And that's when they used, instead of American or Canadian or British or German law, they used natural law. And natural law is easy to understand. It's like, you know, the Ten Commandments. Don't kill, don't steal. Because it is obvious that each and every one of us has within themselves the capacity to distinguish good from evil and right from wrong. For example, if you get the order, kill that two-year-old, you know you can't do that. You must not do that. It's obvious, right? That's what the Nuremberg trials are about. Now, I know that there were a lot of rumors that I was conducting Nuremberg 2.0 with 10,000 medical experts and 10,000 lawyers. This is just framing. I don't know who did that, and I don't know for what purpose, but it has always been false. We, that is, a group of international attorneys who cooperated, who have been cooperating for a year and a half now, we all of us know that the only way to win in the courts of law is through an international cooperation. I have known from the start that the German legal system is totally, utterly incapable of dealing with this. Why is that? Well, I don't know if I told you this, but at the beginning of last year, this is almost precisely a year ago, a judge in the town of Weimar, you may have heard the name from Weimar Republic, he was approached by a woman whose two children, 7 and 9 years old, didn't want to go to school anymore. They couldn't sleep. They had stomach aches. They were waking up screaming in the middle of the night. They didn't want to get PCR tested. They didn't want to wear masks. So she told this judge, you're going to have to help me because my children are being tortured. I think what's going on in the schools is wrong. And he said, well, I'm going to look into this. I'm a judge. I'm not a medical expert or a scientist. But what I usually do is I call upon experts. So he called upon three expert witnesses, three esteemed professors from universities in Germany. One of them happens to be my now good friend Ulrike Kämmerer. She's a professor from Würzburg University who specializes in PCR testing. Another one is who specializes in child psychology. And then there's another woman, a professor who specializes in are masks useful or not. Ultimately, based upon the evidence that he collected from these three experts, he decided this is illegal. There is no factual basis for this. And if there's no factual basis for this, there's no legal basis. This is unconstitutional. School, you can't do this. This was a celebrated decision, worldwide celebrated decision, even though it's a lower court. But 3 weeks after this, his house and his office were searched. His computer and cell phone were seized. The same thing happened to the experts. The same thing happened to the to a friend of the judge, just because she was a friend of his. And the same thing happened to the woman lawyer who represented the children in that case. This was, I think, designed not as a... They didn't want to intimidate the judge because it was obvious that he knew what he was doing. But it was designed to intimidate the rest of the legal community, the judiciary as a whole. And that worked really well. Even though there is now this group of judges and prosecutors, they call themselves critical judges and prosecutors, who are fairly outspoken, is probably no more than 60 judges and prosecutors. And I haven't heard of any decision in favor of any of the plaintiffs in the context of Corona ever since this search and seizure activity. So that's why I said right from the start, it makes no use to file any cases in Germany. I did. I took some high-profile cases. I'm representing, for example, my friend Wolfgang Wodak in a case against so-called fact-checkers. because they said that he's lying when he says the PCR test can't tell us anything about infections. I'm also representing the largest, Europe's largest karaoke bar in Berlin against Drosden. He's the guy who invented the PCR test. And there's several other such cases, but no more than five or six. I'm doing this because I'm getting the mainstream media's attention through this. And by their reporting about these cases, I'm getting out the information, because the mainstream media will not report. They will not listen to us. But I know it's not going to, I don't think it's going to have, none of these cases has a chance of being won. That's why I'm concentrating on or focusing on the U.S. and its legal system, because in parts of the U.S., the system still functions. For example, Florida, that woman who wrote this brilliant decision against the mask mandates, the federal judge. So there's other places. But we don't call this Nuremberg 2.0. Others have called it that, but we don't have anything to do with that. We're doing our own thing, and we are ultimately, however, I do believe there has to be a final reckoning. There has to be something like a Nuremberg trial, but I wouldn't call it that, simply because of this connotation that most of them got away back then. This time, no one shall get away.
Yeah, that's how you want it to be, right? There's this thing you started recently, the grand jury
investigation?
Public opinion.
Yeah. That's a model proceeding that our group of international attorneys agreed upon. We had been using some of the evidence, some of the expert witnesses, in order to get cases filed in other countries, in India, for example, or in South Africa, for example. And we had Zoom conferences in which we spoke with the attorneys in South Africa, with their supporters. We connected them with our experts, and thus we helped them write the complaints, but only as far as the facts are concerned, because the law is different in many of these countries. And but the one thing that we understood is that, and many people try to understand what this is all about by watching all the interviews that we have done with the Corona Investigative Committee. But if you watch one interview and another interview, you will not see the whole picture. And you can't, I mean, no one can watch 102, or I think it's 100, yeah, 102 sessions of the Corona Committee. Most of them are 4, 5, 6 hours long. So we decided to do something to make the whole picture visible for someone who is beginning to ask questions and who just doesn't have the time to watch all these interviews. And we decided we're going to do it as all of us, we're all of us lawyers, we decided to do it in a legal proceeding. And that legal proceeding, the one that we agreed upon, is the grand jury investigation, because it's something that exists in real life here in the U.S. It's what you do when you want to get indictments against serious criminals, but you don't want them to know that you're onto them, that you're after them. So what you do is you have a grand jury of usually 26 people. The other jury, the trial jury, is usually 12 people. That's why it's called a petit jury. It's a French petit jury. And you present to them all of the evidence that you have. And after you're through with that, you ask the jury if this is enough evidence to indict these people. We have six, I think, putative defendants. One is Drosden, because he invented the PCR test, which he claims tells us something about infections. He also invented the lie that they're asymptomatic infections. They don't exist. Anyone who's asymptomatic is healthy. Against Fauci, against Gates, Tedros, the head of the WHO, BlackRock, and Pfizer. They're the figureheads, so to speak. There's many, many more, and many who we don't even see, of course, but you have to start somewhere. And through this proceeding, through this investigation, we took, I think, four or five sets of facts which we believe will show the whole picture. In five, I think, or six sessions which we've conducted. So that is much easier to digest than 102 sessions of the Corona Committee. The first set of facts dealt with the backdrop to all of this, which is, and in this segment, we spoke with geopoliticians, historians, people like Patrick Wood. Explaining how this all started, probably in the 1850s or so, when, you know, Darwin, survival of the fittest, when they had the first ideas about only the strong shall survive. This evolved into what is called eugenics, which is about how only the strong shall survive, how we have to create a better, I guess, a better human being. This all started to pick up speed in the early 1900s, 1907 or so, when both in England and in the United States, they founded the British Eugenics Society, and in the United States, it's the American Eugenics Society, I believe. So most people think it's Hitler who invented the idea of killing people who don't fit the pattern. But no, he didn't invent it. And his war was being financed by the very same people who are pushing these eugenics ideas. It's just that he went completely out of control, and that's why they couldn't continue with this, not out in the open. But right after World War II, when in, I think, 1947, UNESCO was set up, the person who founded it, or one of the co-founders of UNESCO, his name is Julian Huxley. He's the brother of the guy who wrote Brave New World, Aldous Huxley. So Julian Huxley, who was also involved with the British Eugenics Society, he gave a speech when they founded UNESCO. And what he said is something like, eugenics has been given a bad name by Hitler, so we can't really talk about it. But we're going to make sure that very soon we're going to be able to discuss this again. Then it picked up speed this is in 1947, and they couldn't talk about eugenics for a while. But in I think when they had this Operation Lockstep, which was funded by the Rockefellers, that's when they first began to discuss this again. Maybe it was Operation Dark Winter, which is in 2001. Maybe it was Operation Lockstep in 2010, I'm not quite sure. But that is the basis of all of this. I was surprised to hear from one of our experts, Vera Sharaf, who is a Holocaust survivor, great woman. I was surprised to hear her saying, "I can't believe I'm fighting the very same people again who I fought 80 years ago." But that's why she's saying this. This is about eugenics. This is about genocide, ultimately. So the first segment deals with this backdrop. The second segment then leads us into the World Health Organization and its role in this pandemic, its creation of cases through the PCR test. Another segment then talks about the vaccines, which are not vaccines, because the definition of a vaccine is that it makes you immune, and none of these so-called vaccines makes anyone immune. This is what the makers of these products have admitted in the meantime. Well, not in the meantime. They admitted it right from the start. But the general population doesn't know anything about it. They're explicitly saying, we don't know if it works. We don't know if it's effective. And we don't even know if it's safe. Crazy stuff going on. And that is why we have another segment that deals with the psychological backdrop of all of this. Why are people doing this? Killing themselves, in effect. Not all of them, of course, at least not all at once, but why are they doing this? And that has to do with psychology. And the final segment dealt with outright genocide. That's where we interviewed, among others, Vera Sharaf. She came across very powerful. But we still have to finish this up. We have to wrap this up, and that's probably going to happen next week. We had to take a break. I had to take a break, go on vacation with my wife because I hadn't had any vacation in almost 2 years. And now Vivian had to do the same thing. She also went to India. But we're going to wrap things up next week, probably on Wednesday and Thursday. We're going to have additional testimony, a little bit of additional testimony, and then we're going to have our closing arguments, and then we're going to have the jury, the court of public opinion, our viewers vote on this. For at least a year or so, we have been fully aware of the fact that it doesn't make any sense to fight the system. You cannot fix this system. There's no way. It is totally corrupted. They've infiltrated thousands, hundreds of thousands of people into that system on all levels of society, the judiciary, healthcare, very obviously healthcare, but on all levels, education, everywhere. So it makes no sense to fight them. I personally don't care about their ideas about their introducing their own international health regulations as the one world law, I guess you could call it, because I know that in the meantime, in all of our regions in Germany, but also in the United States, as is happening in India, people have begun to understand that democracy is bottom up and not top down. A democracy is if the people, it's grassroots democracy. The people in the regions, in their individual regions, they know best what's good for them. If you have, I guess you could call them centers of competence or regions of competence, I don't know, of 10,000 or 20,000 people or so who agree upon a new judiciary, a new system of judiciary, a new system of education, of healthcare, and of economics. They know what's best for them. They don't need anyone from above, let alone the World Health Organization or anyone else, to tell them what to do. These people are totally out of touch. They're not connected. They're crazy. They're psychopaths. We know what's best for us. And if we have these many different regional new systems, then they will connect with each other. Even on an international basis, they will connect with each other to exchange the best ideas, something like that. But they will not tell each other what to do. No one will tell these regions, these centers of democracy, of real democracy, what to do. So even though I realize this is a grave danger, while we are still caught in this system, it won't be a grave danger once we have enough people who have decided to disconnect from these global corporations and NGOs, which are all run by the same people. Once we have enough people who understand that we cannot trust this system anymore because it's working against us, once we have disconnected ourselves from this system and set up our own systems, we'll be safe. We'll be safe. But things will be a lot worse before they get better, because people only wake up when they're under serious pressure.
When we return to the sovereignty of the individual.
Yeah, that's what this is all about.
Yeah, because really,
it's about the sovereignty of the individual. Yeah. I haven't heard anybody say that before, but it's true. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and acknowledging that everyone has that right, and so you're giving your sovereignty to the government. You want the government to be your god, to be your mom and dad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To give you your allowance, to tell you where to be and when, and how many kids to have, and that's not a world that I want to live in.
No, no, no. We've been doing this for way too long, and look what's come out of this. Lots of crazy people.
Yeah. So I don't actually know the answer to this question myself, because I think about this a lot, but like, what do you think it'll take, say on an individual level, to wake people up? Like, if you had 5 minutes with somebody who had had, you know, every booster and was wearing their mask and, you know, social distancing and all that, I mean, if you had 5 minutes just to sit with them, What would you say?
I think the only way to get people's attention is to get them to question their convictions, to question the reality of what they think that they're convinced of. It, on the one hand, with some people, it may be easier to do it on a one-on-one basis. But on the other hand, I think this is like, you know, we have out where I live in Northern California, most of the people there are ranchers. they know about cattle and stuff. And there's this one guy, he's like a John Wayne type, real cowboy. And one night we sat down and had a couple of beers, and he told us about how to stop a stampede, because that's what we're dealing with, how to stop a stampede. And he explained to us that the only way to do it is by getting as many cowboys as possible to ride in front of the herd, the stampede, and then firing off their rifles, because that is going to cause so much panic that they're going to stop and maybe turn the other way. But if I were to talk to someone on an individual basis, the only way to get his attention is if they believe that you're authentic, if they think that you're trying to convince them of anything or proselytizing, something like that is not going to work. So the only way to get their attention, the only way to get them to listen to you is to make them see that you're authentic. You're in it because you want to help. You're not in it because you want to make money or some other ulterior purpose. If they realize you're authentic, they will trust you. And only if they trust you will they listen to you.